You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 282, the first podcast for the beginning of 2016. Let's get this pony riding. And this is Features Editor John Gentile. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. It's the first for real deal podcast of 2016. I'm excited. 2016 is going to be a great year. We're back in the grind. We're back to the regular groove. Get into the groove, like Madonna says. You know, Papa don't preach. We feel like virgins because this is the first podcast of 2016. And one of the most popular virgins of the Punk News Podcast, you could say he vogues. We've got managing editor Adam White. Managing editor Adam White, how's the voguing coming along? How are you doing?
I am made uncomfortable by the whole intro to this show today.
Are you anti-Madonna? Is that the problem?
I'm just not usually cast into the role of various Madonna characters and idioms and everything like that. But, you know, hi, John. Welcome to 2016. It's much like 2015, except I have some wine.
Well, they have it, and the guy cracking up back there—that's the guy. You could say he doesn't preach. And I'm trying to think of other Madonna hits,
music.
Oh, the guy that you could say is your lucky star. The guy that's always on a holiday. The guy that will take it across the borderline. He's material. He's not a girl, but he's crazy for you. So let's get in the groove because he's going to live to tell us all about his other podcast, Best Midwestern, and wherein he talks about all the hot bands and the Midwest. He talks about emo. He talks about punk rock. He talks about rock. It's podcast producer Greg Simpson. Greg Simpson, open your heart and tell me what's happening over there.
Howdy, y'all. I don't know. Not much happening here. Just teaching and, you know, being punk.
Greg, can you justify your love for the Best Midwestern podcast and tell us about it? Rescue me from my ignorance of your podcast.
Have you not listened to a single episode?
No, I have. I'm just quoting Madonna song titles.
Oh, yeah, you lost me with those references. Yeah, I'm really liking doing Best Midwestern with Scott, having known him since college, which was a long time ago. You know, he was the guy that got me working for – quote unquote working for Punk News back in 2002, and now, you know, we got things going for Punk News again together, teamed up.
And that's Scott who? Because I mean, honestly, you know, Punk News has been rocking for about 15 years now. Some of the listeners might not know who Scott is.
Scott Heisel was, I guess Adam could clear it up. I know I've gone over this multiple times. He wasn't one of the very original Punk Newsers, but he was one of the big three with Adam here, Aubin, and Scott.
Yeah, there was a period in the early 2000s that I like to call the useful years, where we were really useful to the world and did lots of stuff. Honestly, I mean, it was like Aubin running the ship and me and Scott slogging news and reviews stuff out for a long time, and then we staffed up and everything like that, and now. Now he's on to he writes for the papers now. He writes for the floppies, right?
Substream does still do print copy of their magazine.
Where is Substream? Where is it distributed? Because I don't think I've seen it in Canada.
He stayed in Cleveland, so I think Cleveland, which is weird since Alt Press is there too, where he used to work. I know he does a lot of website stuff, so maybe he's just kind of doing it from afar. Maybe.
Anyways, Substream. It's a magazine. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he's one of my best buds. I mean, he did a reading at my wedding. He sang Party Hard with the wedding band at my wedding. So it's pretty cool to chat with him and bullshit and go on tangents on the podcast.
About all those great Midwestern places like Iowa and Mississippi and Utah and...
Utah.
Delaware.
Just naming ones that aren't.
Yes, I'm looking. I'm literally looking at a map of the United States and listing states
that aren't in the Midwest intentionally. Anyway, so we've got our first episode of the year coming out. It'll probably be coming out right around when this episode comes out. You know, sometime the weekend, this weekend, the 9th.
Nope.
I don't know what the date is. 9th, 10th, 11th.
If I bother to post it.
Yeah, we're under your iron fist, so to speak.
My lazy, lazy iron fist. So, John, this is going to be sort of a weird show tonight. We have a bunch of news that happened over the holidays when we were talking about our favorite records and essentially goofing off on the show for a few weeks. So we're going to cover a bunch of stuff that that made waves really over the past month, I guess. But before we do that, we got any mail?
Yeah, we got lots of mail. This is and I'm just going to read some mail. It's covered stuff we've done a little while ago because in the last 3 months, 3 weeks, we were goofing around. This is from Bjarte. This Bjarte says, "Hey guys. Regular listener subscriber from Norway here. I used to have my own radio show, and I really enjoy listening to you guys every week. I just thought I'd give you some quick heads up on the whole mayhem thing from the podcast, as some of the info that you said was incorrect. Lead singer Dead committed suicide by blowing his brains out. Euronymous found him, staged a scene with a shotgun and some other stuff, took pictures of it, and yes, used parts of the brain in necklaces that he sent out to people he considered to be true black metal.
Oh.
Varg Vikernes later stabbed Euronymous to death and was sentenced to 21 years. He now lives in France with his wife and homeschooled his children in English by putting together a machine gun and having them identify the various parts.
Norway is awesome.
He seemed like a patient and kind father, but I'm sure he would not be allowed to have custody of them back in Norway. I'm sure Wikipedia will correct any factual errors given by me here, if any. Anyhow, I appreciate that you guys take the time out of your busy lives to entertain us, both with the podcast and the site. Cheers from Bjarte."
Holy wow. Shit.
Can't make that stuff up.
And this is from Daniel. Daniel says, "Hey guys, I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed the Sandinista podcast. I went back and listened to most of the record ahead of time, and it was cool to hear some of the original versions, get into the minutiae of the record, and listen to the debate. It was really good to have Tom on as a counter to Adam and John. It made for a good listen. It would be cool to have something like that on a more regular basis, maybe monthly. A nice change of pace from the news and back and forth of the regular weekly podcast. I'd be interested in hearing similar conversation on other controversial or groundbreaking albums. Love the podcast. Keep it up. Signed, Dan."
Yeah, as the editor, I would agree that that was a pretty cool episode. I mean, I don't know if monthly would be a thing, like we'd miss out on news and stuff, but maybe like half episodes, like a segment of news and a segment about a classic episode or something. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, see, I want to do a lot of spin-off podcasts, but how many podcasts do people want to get fed? And I think the answer is one podcast a week. So I think we could do two podcasts a week, but there might be too many shows, you know?
All right.
It's tough. I'd be hesitant about creating a whole other show that people have to subscribe to, because then I don't know, it feels like we'd be trying to fight our way uphill. At the same point, I don't want to do too much off-brand stuff to as turn away people that I guess tune in for the normal shit. I don't know. We'll figure out a medium. But do you want to tease what the idea is for the next one of these type of Sandinista shows?
I don't think I know what it is.
I came up with it the other day. Everyone thought it was a good idea.
Oh, Van Halen 1?
No, not Van Halen 1. All right, so here's what we want to do, people. I want to do a show. I don't know if we can do this in one show, but we'll try. I want to do a show about all the Ramones records.
Oh, yeah, this was a good idea.
Yes.
This was a good idea.
Like, the Ramones records post, like, 1984. Like, after, I don't know, like, Too Tough to Die, I guess. Like, that and after, maybe. I don't know. But I don't know where I'm going to draw the line here. Maybe like the stuff once Tommy was like no longer in the band but producing. I don't know where exactly we draw the line, but there was like a whole ton of Ramones records that came out in like the 80s and 90s that no one really gives a shit about. And I think that we could revisit those.
I think that's a great idea, and I think we should do that. Send us your ideas at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Andrew. Andrew said, I wanted to thank you all for the Sandinista episode. While it's not my favorite Clash album, or even the one I think was their best, it is one I respect the most. It's the last album I have to buy on vinyl to complete my studio albums by The Clash, and your episode convinced me to finally get off my ass and buy a copy, so thanks again. From Andrew.
Does Andrew own a copy of Cut the Crap?
This is from Bren. Bren says, hello, Punk News Podcast team. A big thank you for your podcast in 2015 and helping a 34-year-old professional in Australia keep in touch with the punk news and tunes from abroad. Your 2015 wrap-up show was top class, and I thoroughly enjoyed the extra tracks being played as it helped me connect more with what you were reflecting on. I love that you play more new music on your podcast in 2016. I would love for you to play more new music on your podcast in 2016. In 2015, I stumbled up across your podcast and have looked forward to the shows every week. You guys keep me up to date with everything punk-related, and I cannot express my gratitude enough for doing this. Living in Australia, we don't get the amount of punk music in comparison to North America, and the podcast helps a poor soul teacher filter through the quality. A time-poor school teacher filtered through quality. I am now a devoted fan of Nightbirds, Dilly Dally, Screaming Females, The Dirty Nail, War on Women, and Pairs. Keep up the good work in 2016, and don't be afraid to play and report on some quality Australian music, such as The Smith Street Band, Clowns, Violin Soho, Luca Brasi, Royal Headache, The Bennies, Camp Cope, and Lincoln Lefevre. All the best for 2016 from Brandon.
I really liked that Royal Headache record. I don't think I ended up listing it at the end of the year. It was only because I remember I really liked it, but then because it's a band that I have no context for, I didn't. I had some sort of mental break where I'm like, is this a band that I should be re-listening to and really digging into, or is this a band that is going to make me sad because they're part of some scene that I don't really care about. And I completely blanked on it, but thinking about it right now, yeah, the new Royal Headache record was really good. So, cool. I will check out some of those other bands. Thank you.
And this is from, and as always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We love getting your mail. Send us some messages. This is from Tuffy. Tuffy says, do you guys have any tips or tricks on removing price stickers from LP covers?
Goo gone.
Would Goo Gone eat the paper?
I know how to do it. If you guys honestly don't know how to do it.
Goo Gone might eat the paper. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, what do you got?
Well, first of all, I'll say I noticed that a lot of the punk legends like Jello and Keith Morse, they leave the price sticker on. So I've always left the price sticker on my records because A, it lets me know how much I paid for it. B, for some reason, leaving the price sticker on it reminds me of where and when I got it. And it kind of, I guess, keeps alive the thrill of finding a certain rare record you wanted to find. And also, I think it gives it a certain history if you leave the price tag on. So I always leave the price tags on my records. Do you guys do that?
I kind of like that, too. I like going through records and being like, oh, I got this when I went to Amoeba and spent way too much money in 2006, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, I have a copy of Pills Happy album behind me, and someone punched a hole through it with like a hole punch. How do I fix that, John?
You should. You know what that hole punch is, Adam?
It's a promotional copy.
It's a promotional copy, or it's a cutout, depending on one of the two.
Okay, now that's more interesting. It's not just the fucking hole. Okay, how do you get the sticker off if you have to?
Here's how you get the sticker off is you have to peel off a little bit. Once you get the little bit of it off, then you're fine. So you peel off as much as you can. Then you use the part that you've peeled off to act as, I guess, for use of a better word, a magnet. And you just keep dabbing the portion still on the record with the part that you've peeled off. Eventually, the sticky part will stick to the sticky part and none will be left over on your record.
This is some MacGyver shit. I like that.
Do you lick it a bunch?
No, you don't lick it.
Oh. What if you like to lick it?
Well, you can lick whatever you want if you'd like to lick it, as long as you have consent. You know, I mean, that's the rule. So,
one of my students today was sniffing a glue stick like crazy, and they're non-toxic. I think, you know, those Elmer's ones. I don't think there's any fumes, but I thought he was going to put it on his lips like chapstick, but luckily he didn't.
All right. Well, you know, I was going to play an old song, but we got a request from our friends down in Australia to play a new track. So I think I will play a new track. The new track that I will play will be the following track. It came out in 2015, and it's a very
you know what you're doing.
It's installing.
It's a very good track. The track is by a band called. Les Butcherettes. I talked about them last week, but we didn't actually play one of their songs. Les Butcherettes have a song called Sold Less Than Gold. It's about the international sex trade, but it's actually sort of written like a new wave song. So Les Butcherettes is a great song. The front singer is Teresa Suarez, Terry Genderbender. They're a really far out punk-ish rock band. This is off their new album called A Raw Youth, and the track is called Sold Less Than Gold, out on Ipecac Records. Let's talk about some news, boys. It's been a while since we've been on the podcast just talking about news. And so just like we're back, another famed punk rock hallmark is back. What is back, you would say? CBGB's. It's back. The famed punk rock club, the famed New York City punk rock club, CBGB's, OMFUG's, has reopened. However, it has not reopened as a music venue. It has reopened as an airport restaurant in not even New York, in New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey. I believe it's Newark, New Jersey, not Newark, New York. I'm almost sure it's Newark, New Jersey. If you've ever been to Newark, New Jersey, it is not the it's not a bad town, but it's not a pretty town.
I didn't get mail about this.
It's Baltimore without all the charm. So anyways, CBGB's is now, it's called CBGB's LAB for lounge and bar, and there you can order $9 deviled eggs and a $14 cheeseburger. I've got some thoughts on this. Greg, what's your thought? Is this a way to keep punk rock alive? Is this crass commercialization? Will this be successful? Has punk gone mainstream, or is this just like you see in certain Eastern countries, an appropriation of American symbol without any meaning behind it, and they just like the way it looks?
I guess the last thing. It's kind of the worst things I've ever read.
This is the worst thing you've ever
read? Oh, no. I'm saying hyperbole. But, I mean, I remember thinking it was a little weird going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland and just seeing the, you know, the awning there. I think it was the original one. I don't know. Are they moving it to this new?
No, they're putting like a logo on the restaurant. Like the window of the restaurant in the airport will say CBGB. That's it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure the business will be all right because people will just go there just kind of see what the fuck's going on, whether they think it's a good idea or not. But it's pretty embarrassing.
People will go there because they have a layover and they need a cheeseburger. I mean, airports are pretty weird places to have anything. I mean, you have a captive audience, so you. I mean, now I've never been in the Newark airport, so maybe it's one of those fancy airports where there's a million options and it's very nice. But you're still in an airport, right? So you don't go there as like it's going to be like what behind security in the airport, I assume, right? Like as you're waiting for your flight, you can go in there and get some $9 deviled eggs. So it's not a kind of thing that you can go to as a tourist unless you're. You're going to go through airport security, and they probably don't want you to go through airport security for no fucking reason. So
it depends. The Indianapolis airport, which is, you know, it's a shitty airport, but it has like its big like food court kind of thing is actually before security. And then once you get through security, there are like, you know, coffee places and other little things. But the main restaurants are before the security checkpoint.
Not in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, they're behind the checkpoint.
Hmm.
You know, I was once, and I wandered out of the secure area that I should have been in, like into the non-secure area, like an idiot. And then I had to like go back through security, like a complete moron. Like I was there on a layover, and I was just wandering about. And then I was wandering, I turned around, and I looked behind me, and there was like a dude in a chair, and he kind of looked at me, and I looked at him, and then he shook his head, like, "Nope, you ain't coming back through here." And I was like, "Ah, fuck!" So I had to. Go back and like do the walk of shame back through the whole security line.
Walk of shame at the airport.
Yeah.
Listen, I mean, this doesn't even matter. First of all, CBGB's is a famous venue, but I mean, it was famously a pretty shitty place. The sound was bad. The bathroom was no one picked up on my little joke that I put in here. There's no word on whether the new company will keep the bathroom authentic as to the original venue. CBGB's had a notoriously terrible bathroom. Not that I'm saying CBGB's was a terrible place. It was cool that they booked a lot of punk bands when punk rock was not cool. They booked a lot of punk rock when punk rock was cool. But even so, not that many other places were booking punk rock. So the bands there were cool. I don't know if the venue itself was that cool. But I mean, like, is this even worth getting upset about? Does it really matter that the name CBGB's is on it? I mean, this is stupid. It's crass commercialization. But does it matter? I mean, does it really matter at all?
It's like being mad at someone who wears a CBGB shirt who you would think is like, oh, they're not punk enough to be wearing that. Who the fuck cares, you know? Oh, and John, by the way, do you know who the first punk band to ever play CBGBs was?
I don't. Let me guess. Is it the Police?
Television.
Oh, there you go.
Yep. Previously talked about off air, so no one knows what the fuck I'm talking about.
Was Richard Hell in the band at the time?
Probably. Yeah.
Let's just play Richard Hell songs for the rest of the whole
thing. I'm not a huge Richard Hell fan, to tell you the truth.
And Tom Verlaine was dating Patti Smith at the time.
Oh, that whole scene is wonderful. Oh, God. All right. CBs, whatever. Let's talk about Columbia House, speaking of dead things that we're trying to resurrect. So as you guys may recall, earlier in the year, the owner of Columbia House, which is a company called Filmed Entertainment Incorporated, they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which meant that the Columbia House operation was facing possible sale or liquidation. So now an investment banker by the name of John Lipman, this is why everyone tunes into the Punk News podcast to hear about what investment bankers are doing. He bought the company for $1.5 million in a liquidation sale, and he has now stated that he is intending to relaunch Columbia House as a vinyl service. There's no really specific plans for this. But he did state, and this is a quote, "For a category that is meaningful and growing rapidly, you don't see a whole lot of choice." So there you go. So if there's anything ever to come of this, I guess we'll talk to you about it. I have a thought about this, but I'll let you guys go. John, you I know were a Columbia House guy. You have talked much about how Columbia House helped you get into punk. What do you think of this?
Well, I was a Columbia House maniac back in the day, and Columbia House really did help you discover new music. You would read the little blurbs, and frankly, you'd have to take a chance, which was part of the fun of music. Columbia House could not serve that purpose now because the internet exists, YouTube exists, iTunes exists. So the only purpose that Columbia House serves now is basically as a shopping distributor. The fact is people buying records generally don't like to order records from the mail. They'd like to go to – I mean, I kind of separate record buyers into two groups, and it might be a little not cocky is not the right word, dismissive of me, but there's people that like to buy like only new records and people that are real record collectors like myself. Those people that dig and, you know, go through all the old stuff and maybe check out some new stuff too, but really dig through the bins. That's the real record collector. The other kind of record collector is someone that'll buy a Fleetwood Mac record for $36 once every 4 months. That's who this guy's marketing to, but the reason those people go to record stores is to feel hip and feel like they're cool. And I mean, honestly, a lot of them are kind of hip and cool. I mean, I'm not hip and cool, but they are. So what can I say? But what I'm saying though is, I don't know if I wish this guy well or not. I don't wish this guy ill. I don't really care if his Columbia House is popular or not. I don't think it will be popular because, like I said, people don't use Columbia House as a discovery device, and people buying vinyl records like to actually go to the shop and pick them up. They don't like to order them through magazines or through the internet generally. I don't think I would have spent $1.5 million on this because the only thing he's really buying is the name, and I don't know if people really cherish the name Columbia House that much. I mean, maybe they do, but I just think it's – I think Columbia House was an interesting and useful tool whose time has passed, and resurrecting it as a vinyl service – I don't think that many people are going to order vinyl from it, particularly because Columbia House was not particularly cheap unless you knew how to game the system. And I don't see them gaming the system on vinyl records because they're much more expensive to produce than the CDs.
I subscribed to – what was the other one? It was a BMG?
BMG Music Club and Columbia House were the two ones, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I did that one. I don't even remember like how much total money I would have spent on it. You know, you get that first deal. I don't remember if I ended up getting ripped off in the end or not, but I agree with you. The cost of vinyl and shipping vinyl and all that's going to kind of ruin their any possible deals they could have. And also agreeing with you about the kind of releases that they're going to stock. Yeah, it's probably going to be all new, like you said, and it's going to be like, oh, some top 40 bands are now pressing vinyl because it looks, you know, they think it's cool. But are people that are really into vinyl going to want the releases that they have to offer? I don't think so.
There is another angle to this too that I think works against it. It's working against everyone right now, and I don't know how this Columbia House venture is going to surmount it. Vinyl's at capacity at the moment as far as manufacturing goes. You are constantly hearing complaints from the guys that run small labels, the guys that were pressing vinyl back before the vinyl resurgence happened, so punk labels basically, that it's taking months now to get anything turned around. It's taking, in some cases, you know, longer than half a year to get things turned around. And it's to the point where it's hurting labels and it's hurting bands. Because it means, you know, if you're a band, you go and you record something, you want to go hit the road and sell a 7-inch with you. Well, all of a sudden your plans get all fucked up because you can't actually get the 7-inches for months after you want those to go be manufactured. And this is all happening because of all the collector stuff that I think a lot of the small labels are doing, all of your billion colors of vinyl that they're doing for collectors. But more so than that, it's being capacity is being taken up by exactly what John said. They're trying to press like another copy of like Tuscan Rumors for people to go buy. Things that don't need to be repressed that are all of a sudden in the pipeline. That capacity is being taken up by like silly record store day releases that don't need to exist, like that silly Clash reissue of the first LP that came out this past Black Friday record store day that was sort of useless for anyone.
But so it's on Protex Blue, Adam. Protex
Blue and White Riot Split or something like that, right? Like, yay. Anyways, but it's like that. That's all killing capacity. So there is a real problem where there are lots of people right now trying to get record plants back online, but it's one of those things. It's a little bit of a specialized manufacturing process. Like you can't just go start a plant that prints that presses vinyl. You have
guy, he spent $1.5 million to get Columbia House. He should have put $1.5 million towards building a fucking plant that can press the more records.
You're right, Greg. You're absolutely right.
So now there's all kinds of interesting stories right now about people like grabbing like mothballed record pressing plants from like Bulgaria or something and like trying to bring the equipment back and get it all online. But like it's a real problem. This equipment is, you know, it's either incredibly expensive to manufacture new or isn't being, you know, manufactured new, or at least not at a cost anyone wants to pay, which means you have to find old shit equipment, try to get it back online, try to get someone that remembers how to use it to keep up with all this demand. So all of a sudden into that you throw this resurgent Columbia House that wants to try to like bulk sell records over the mail that can't help the the overall supply and demand pressure that's on the whole screwing up the whole vinyl industry right now. So, it's one of those things where like that was my first thought when this came to light, and I'm like, if this is Mr. Investor guy, what is he? He's an investment banker, and he's got $1.5 million to spend on something like this. Does that kind of when that kind of thing come up? if I was the business news reporter that was interviewing him about this story, that would be the thing that I'd be really curious about was where are you going to get this shit? Who's going to make it?
I think he's. Go ahead, John.
Columbia House, I don't know if they press – actually, Columbia House did specially press records.
I don't mean they need to press them, but they're going to need to – if they're intending to move a bunch of them, then someone needs to press them. So even if it's the labels that are pressing them and then giving them the Columbia House, it's just more pressure on a system that can't handle it.
So you think the company itself will cause more records to be sold? See, the way I saw it is he would just buy a whole bunch of records from the distributor and distribute them himself.
Well, sure, but then the distributor is going to go back to the label and say, hey, we sold a bunch of records to Columbia House, and the label's going to press more of them. I don't know.
That's good for the ultimate consumer, though, because that means there's actually – that's a supply chain management issue.
It's good if you want a copy of Tusk.
For cheap, yeah.
It's not good if you're like Red Scare and trying to like put out a 7-inch for a band that's going on tour in 3 weeks, right? So
I love how our go-to insulting of new record example is always Fleetwood Mac. Well, listen,
no one's standing up for them. But write us Fleetwood Mac defenders. What are you gonna do?
Well, speaking of small labels feeling the squeeze, Planet X Records is closing up shop. They're going to be around for a little while longer, a couple of months, and then that will be that. Founder and operator Chris Clavin has basically said any band that wants the records can have them back. He says it's a money loser these days. He says he doesn't have the financial it doesn't make financial sense for him to keep the label open because he's losing money. He doesn't want to pay for the space, and basically just seems like he's kind of tired of doing it. He said there's not going to be a Planet X Fest this year either. Greg the Simp, did this hit close to home?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that I was kind of outside of that scene looking in. I mean, I was never like one of those guys, but I liked a lot of those bands. You know, it was based in Bloomington for a good the majority of its run, and that's where I used to live. And I knew Chris. You know, I wasn't like good friends with him, but like a lot of those guys, I knew them, you know, playing with their bands. Or just, you know, seeing them around at shows. And it's a cool scene. I mean, a lot of people rag on them like you guys were. You know, there's a lot of cheap shots you can take at these kind of bands. But they're really, you know, it's a really nice kind of scene. I mean, maybe it is kind of insular and like a bubble. But a lot of really nice people, a lot of really cool bands. You know, they always keep it DIY, all ages. I mean, all that kind of stuff that people, you know, the punks love. And it was kind of sad to see it go because it was pretty much run by two people. And then Sam, I'm not sure what her last name was, actually passed away. And then Chris was doing it by himself for forever. So that's a lot of shit for one guy to do. So kudos to him for keeping it up for 21 years, I believe, 21, 22. And I'm sad to see him go, but I know he'll keep making music. All these bands and musicians, they'll keep making music. You know, that DIY thing will still flourish with those people with that mindset.
Planet X was always a really interesting label for me, and I mean I was joking about it before the show, because they during the folk punk sort of explosion after Against Me initially became popular, and you saw a bunch of those bands riding in, you know, there's definitely a sense, at least online, that a lot of the Planet X bands that were doing a lot of that stuff, you know, before that happened, were being maybe kind of like unfairly lumped into that trend. But they've always been, you know, they've always been a label that has, I want to say more than anyone else in the modern age, I think, that, you know, that has embodied that kind of like fiercely uncompromised, almost discordy, you know, sense of community about it. And I say that like not actually really being a fan of the style of punk that they were putting out, but like, you know, they were pretty inscrutable. Like, no one, you know, you could never question the intentions of Planet X. Like, they were doing their own thing. You know, if you didn't like their thing, well, whatever. But the, you know, they stuck to what they were doing. They never deviated for it. They never went and tried to chase, you know, the big money or anything like that. And the people that love them, love them. Like, they put on their own fest every year where people were coming out that were, you know, that were into those bands. And you don't see labels, even labels that people really like, have create that deep of a sense of community these days. So I, you know, I absolutely give them that. And I'm like, cause like there's a lot of labels that I like, but you know, they're labels. They put out a record and they'll post some tour dates that a band's going on. And it never seems like a, like so much of a little weird society as Planet X always seemed.
Yeah.
And I mean, it Planet X has always to me been, I want to say somewhat, it's felt somewhat impenetrable in that, like, clearly, and I guess you kind of alluded to this, like, so many of the bands that were on this label were, you know, members of the other bands that were on this label, that were friends of the other bands that were on this label, where mm-hmm. like if you were not, you know, if you weren't really meshed into what was going on there, you probably lose a little bit of context that's, you know, that's essential to know about, you know, like, why, you know, why should I care too much about the fact that, you know, Chris Klavan is releasing a split with, I don't know, Andrew Ghost, Lips or Ghost something Life. Like that. Yeah. So it was never anything I was able to like get into, but it was always something where if I had to like, you know, write you a list of five DIY punk labels, this would have been one of them. So, you know, it's sad to see them go from that end of it.
From my perspective, this is total. I respect the label. Like, I'm not really a big fan of really any of the bands on the label. Although I couldn't tell you that many bands on the label. And this is total. You know, I guess what do they call that? Sunday morning quarterbacking? Is it Monday morning? What's that phrase? Monday morning quarterbacking.
Sports.
I mean, and I'm not saying Chris is wrong here, but I'm saying from my perspective, I actually disagree with a lot of his. I disagree with a lot of the label's fundamental points. Like, one of the label's main things, their main quote is, if it ain't cheap, it ain't punk. And I actually disagree with that a lot. For me, punk rock, a big aspect of punk rock is paying respect to the arts and paying respect to the artist. By not paying an artist or paying an artist very little for their work, I don't think you're respecting an artist. I think a better phrase would be, if it's not a fair price, it's not punk. You know, I don't think you're really doing any bands or artists a service by paying them very little for their work. To the opposite, I think bands should be compensated to the maximum amount feasible or reasonably in order to ensure that they can keep doing what they can keep doing. Another thing that he said
Hey, one quick little tidbit before you make your next point. A lot of this money was coming out of Chris's pocket, as in, if you order from planetx.com, it's free shipping. So, like, that's one thing. Like, that's not coming out of the band's pay. That's coming out of his pocket, like the packaging and, you know,
I'm not saying
postage.
I'm not saying Chris is a bad guy. I'm not saying that at all.
Sure.
I'm saying from my perspective, cutting your own throat or paying a band a little bit or not paying yourself anything is not a – everybody needs rewards to keep doing what they want to keep doing. You know, in punk rock, there's this idea that doing it in of itself is a reward. But the problem is that ignores the realities in life of things that you also have to take care of. You got to pay your electric bill. You got to pay your water bill. You got to pay this. You got to pay that. You got to pay this. So you need some sort of reward to keep going. So choking out yourself in the name of cheapness, you know, I don't think really achieves anything except for to satisfy somebody that just wants cheap shit. I think a big problem in punk rock is the people that aren't really doing anything want cheap shit or they want free shit and they want to be served to rather than vice versa, paying respect to people actually making interesting art.
Mm-hmm. I do agree with you on that end. I was just kind of playing devil's advocate. Oh, I mean,
like I said, I'm not saying Chris is a bad guy. I'm just saying he and I have a very different perspective when it comes to these kinds of things. The other thing.
Yeah, sure. Well, every band I've been in, I always argue for you need to value your own work if you want other people to value it. So, like, for example, I think, you know, $10 for your full-length album on CD, perfectly reasonable. Like, some bands might be like, oh, well, it only cost us, you know, $6.50 to make. Why don't we charge $7? I mean, come on.
I $10 to $12 is the right price for a CD, if you ask me. To $12. I also refuse to give in to the social media push to be more aggressive and advertise and market our bands. What he's saying is if it's punk rock marketing or advertising bands is counter to the ethos of punk rock. I disagree, and really that was underscored by a quote by Boots Riley. Here's what of the Coup said. The whole idea that you can opt out of capitalism is some Walden Pond bullshit. It's some bullshit that allows people to stand by and not organize. That being said, if you had an enterprise where you are selling records so artists can pay their bills, you are not being more virtuous by putting out records and not letting people know about it. And I agree with Boots Riley. I think if you're going to put out a record and if you're going to engage in the, quote, capitalist system at all, you might as well try to get the most out of it you can without hurting other people. And like I said, I'm not dissing Chris Clavin. I'm just saying from my perspective, I have a different perspective than he does when it comes to making art. And I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm not saying I am saying I'm right. But, you know, that's just my opinion. You know, what do you want me to say?
I found that particular point odd as well because for the most part, social media is a free way for you to advertise your bands.
But,
you know?
Yeah, but I mean, I agree. But that, but also, it's getting tougher and tougher because Facebook is getting smarter and smarter about how to, you know, drown shit unless you pay for it. However, I will say, it sounds like I'm dissing on Chris Clavin. I don't know him, but let me tell you, he said he was going to do something and he did it, and he did it way better than 99% of the other people. So kudos to him for doing it for 20 years or whatever and putting out a lot of records and, you know, getting a lot of bands known. So kudos to him for that, you know.
Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. So. All right. Should I play something?
I think you should.
Okay. So I did not even know this, but Crutchfield – okay. Allison Crutchfield and – shit. What is it? Katie Crutchfield and Allison Crutchfield you might know from their band P.S. Elliott. And then Allison went on to do Swearin', currently a current band, and Katie is currently doing Waxahachie. And I did not know that even while P.S. Elliott was still together, she released the first Waxahachie release on Planet X. She did a split with Chris. And let's see, what was the release called? It was called Dragon. It was a cassette-only release called Dragon. It has 5 songs from Chris and 5 songs of Waxahachie, and it came out in 2011. So I have a feeling a lot of people haven't heard this, even if they're fans of Waxahachie, because I had no idea it existed. So let's listen to this very lo-fi first recordings of Waxahachie. This song is called Whiskey and Math.
And we are back. That was Waxahachie doing Whiskey and Math off the Waxahachie Chris Clavin split. And if you want to buy it, you can't because Planet X Records is now closed up.
It's still on Bandcamp, so you can get it digitally for
closed
free.
Closed up. Closed
for
up.
For free. It's free. Name your price.
Shut down. Well, speaking of something that's not free, the owner of the world's most expensive record has been arrested for fraud. That's right. Everybody's buddy, Martin Shkreli, the guy that raised the price of HIV pills from – well, not pills that treat HIV, among other things, from $13 to $750. The guy that paid $2 million for Wu-Tang's one-of-a-kind Once Upon a Time in Shaolin record that has not even listened to it was arrested for fraud. What was he arrested for? He was arrested for securities fraud. That is basically creating a pyramid scheme essentially to defraud investors while he spends $2 million of their dollars on records that he doesn't listen to. I've got one solid thought about this. Adam and Greg, I don't know if you have anything to add to this.
This guy was a super huge dick and tried to use the internet to like fan the flames of his overall dictitude. And now it has bitten him in the ass and the world is collectively laughing at him. So... what can I add?
I was actually having a little bit of crisis over this because I do believe in capitalism. I don't think capitalism is a perfect system, but I don't think any system is a perfect system. However, lately, in the past, I don't know, 5 years or so, I've really been worried that the upper class is separating from the middle class, which is disappearing into the lower class, and that is we are getting back to the dark ages where super rich people just spit on poor people and stomp on them with no conscience whatsoever, and there's nothing the poor people can do about it because they have no assets and no fuel, no power at all, and the rich people have everything and are just completely not even ashamed – just be horrible people because they're so rich and they can do what they can. And so when Martin Shkreli, who just kept winning, you know, he was making all these millions, he's a horrible person. If you raise the price of a pill that saves people's lives from $14 to $750, the only reason you're doing that is because you know they'll die if you don't charge – if they don't buy it. So basically you are making people pay for their life, which is despicable. I mean, if he was a nice guy, he would lower the pill, wouldn't he? So I mean, but he had no remorse about that. He had no conscience. He was like, no matter what people said, he would insult the people and say he was right for what he was doing. He was allowed to do what he was doing, and he was legally allowed to do what he was doing, which I think is kind of messed up too. But he had no remorse, and he just seemed to be so smug and so pleased with himself that he was so rich and that he was able to stomp on weaker people and that the weaker people could not do anything about it. And I was having a crisis. I was like, is this what capitalism is? Maybe I need to rethink my whole stance on capitalism. And maybe I still will, but when he was arrested as for fraud, that really did – warm my heart and say, well, maybe things aren't quite as bad as I thought they were. If this asshole is being arrested, then maybe the system isn't quite as broken as it seems to be.
When you said that the upper class was going to pull away and separate from the middle and lower class, all I could think of was the saucer section of the Enterprise D separating from the lower part of the ship.
What side would Picard be on, you think? Would he be upper class or lower class?
Of course he'd be in the upper class.
How about Worf?
Oh, poor Worf.
How about Geordi? How about Data?
Geordi's down in the bottom.
How about Data?
We're off topic.
I love that show.
What are we talking about? This dick? I don't know.
He's a dick.
Greg, do you have anything to add about this guy getting his comeuppance? Or?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. The only thing I could add is that if you believe in karma, if karma is a thing, this is a perfect example of how shit just goes wrong for people that are assholes.
This is great, man. This is great.
So revisiting – oh, God, I started laughing when I just looked at this story. When we're revisiting some stories that have come up in recent weeks that have had some follow-up. So on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame file, John, is this your story? Did you post this picture on here? You did. Oh, God. All right. I can't even stop looking at it. End of Deep Purple Who else here? Steve Miller and Chicago. That is the group of five acts that are going to be the 2016 inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. The ceremony is going to take place on April 8th, 2016. The nominees that did not make the cut include Nine Inch Nails, The Cars, Chic, Janet Jackson, The JBs, Chaka Khan, Los Lobos, Spinners, Yes, and the Smiths. And if you look at the story on Punk News for this, it has a big frowny face photo of Morrissey on the top of it. And I can't stop laughing at it.
Yeah, that's pretty great, John.
There we go. Rock Roll Hall of Fame nominees are in there now. So NWA, Cheap Trick, Deep Purple, the Steve Miller Band, or just Steve Miller?
Just Steve Miller, not the members of the band, which is
what?
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe they'll come in later. Didn't that happen? Who else has that happened with? Where?
Well, Clapton's been in three times.
Okay, right, with Yardbirds by himself and
no, I think Clapton, Derek and the Dominoes, and Cream.
Oh, Yardbirds aren't in there?
They might. Maybe Clapton's in four times. Could be. That's could be
possible. I found it odd that the Cars aren't in. They'd be my biggest pick for, because they've been around. I mean, the Spinners too. I mean, there's some really old bands in there. So I guess Yes as well. Yes and the Cars. I mean, the Smiths, not as old. Nine Inch Nails, 90s, you know. But it seems like those older bands should be getting their shot.
I think the JB should have got in. Like JBs are pretty important. I mean, that's James Brown's backing band. I think they should have got in, to tell you the truth. I don't know. Cheap Trick is pretty important to rock. I like Steve Miller Band a lot, but I think JB should have got in before Steve Miller. I mean, Steve Miller had some cool radio hits, but did he really change music? JB's changed music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So did Nine Inch Nails and the Smiths and the Cars and Chic.
Yeah, and who can name another Deep Purple song other than Smoke on the Water?
Oh, I can. I've got
do it. Without looking at your iTunes.
Space Truckin', Space Truckin', Samurais, Burning Flame or Flames in the Mind Eye or whatever.
Well, you're more of a rock fan than I. Classic rock.
Blue Oyster Cult's better than Deep Purple. The Blue Oyster Cult should have got it before Deep Purple. Anyways, I mean, we've had this discussion before. We want to drag it out. Like, what is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Is it the Music Hall of Fame? Is it the Oldies Hall of Fame? Like, there doesn't really seem to be a rhyme or reason from why certain bands get in and others don't, aside from marketing. What can you do? It's a private organization. What can you do?
You guys heard that?
That's right, Cat.
Listen, that's Fry.
Speaking of what can you do, you can decide to go out to Coachella this year. Coachella, there was a resounding meh across the internet when they announced the Coachella lineup. However, there are some cool punk rock bands playing. Rancid is playing Coachella. I think they're doing Out Come the Wolves again, which they've been doing that for about 2 years now. They're also doing The Damned is playing, of course, which I'm glad to see that. It's definitely time The Damned got some more American notice. You know, for some reason, The Damned are just criminally ignored in America. I think it's because even though they broke up a lot, they never really, really broke up. Rising punk band from Philadelphia. What the hell's the name of that band? I can't remember. The huge band right now is
Sheermag.
Sheermag from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
X-Hex is playing and Front Bottoms is playing. Also, Guns N' Roses. Oh, Ice Cube's playing, which is cool. Run the Jewels is playing, which is cool. Guns N' Roses is reuniting with Slash, Axl, and I think Izzy. I think those are the three that are in the band.
I'm just looking through the list here, and I'm just running through this small band list to see is that if there's anyone in here that.
I mean, honestly, there's nothing you really need to see here. I mean, Run the Jewels is awesome, but they tour a lot. You know, The Damned rule, but you can pretty much see them. You know, Vandals is playing, which is cool, but there's nothing here that's really blowing me away, man.
You know, as far as the stupid indie rock shit that I like, Courtney Barnett is playing, and she's from Australia, so. I mean, I'm pretty sure she's touring the U.S. pretty heavily right now, but I think, you know, chances are limited before she holds up for another record. Deer Hunter's playing, Unknown Mortal Orchestra is playing, as far as, you know, all those Pitchfork bands I listen to.
What's Deer Hunter? There's two Deer Hunters. Is this D-E-E-R or D-E-A-R?
With Bradford Cox, D-E-E-R.
Yeah, that band's actually, like, pretty crazy, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And I like that band.
It's so trippy. Trippy psychedelic shit.
Savages is playing too. That's a pretty popular band. But I mean, honestly, is there any like band that you guys would have to go see? There's nothing here that I have to go see, you know.
No, there's nothing here that's really jumping out to me. I mean, I wanted to comment on how it's weird that the Vandals are playing this. I mean, good for them. If I had to make you a list of like 50 punk bands that would potentially play Coachella, the Vandals would be like, they wouldn't make the top 300. Like, not they don't deserve whatever they get. It's just that, like, who would have thought the Vandals, like, was anyone thinking of the Vandals? Like, someone was booking Coachella, and then they were like, you know who we need to get is the Vandals.
I actually have a little bit of insight to this, Adam, if you'd like to know.
Is it because Joe Escalante is the lawyer for Coachella?
It could be. However, some larger music festivals with inside – they don't hold open – they do not hold open calls, but with inside the industry, if you're a label, you can submit your picks that you think they should hire or pay to come play.
Hey, good for them. Honestly, that's the highest. I mean, I don't want to make fun of the Vandals or anything. Just like they're a band that's been around for a long time. No one outside of punk rock gives a shit about them at this point. Like they have their fans, and it feels like no one in punk rock at this point. Like if the Vandals turned around and said they were releasing another record, you know, Vandals fans would be into it. You know, the fans of like SoCal punk of that era would be into it, but it's not going to make a huge amount of waves. It's not the next Against Me record or anything like that. Like they just they're a veteran band that never they never created the like later career excitement that a band like say like Bad Religion would do. So it's just it's odd to see them among the list of all these hip bands, you know.
For sure.
I'm mad the Damned are so small. Like the Damned are smaller than the Arcs. They're smaller than Grimes. Well, Grimes is actually pretty popular right now. They're smaller than Churches or Halsey or James Bay, Disclosure, Zedd. Like the Damned are one of the first three English punk bands, but I understand that they're really not that popular, like outside of the punk realm, and most people don't know who they are. But I mean, part of the Coachella like list is that it does pay respect to the importance of a band, even if they're not that important. I think the Damned should have been bigger. But what can I say? You know, what are you gonna do?
Lush is playing. I think so. Lush is playing. Do you guys know Lush?
Yes, 1988 to 1996, five albums.
They just reunited. Yeah, female fronted shoegaze stuff became kind of Britpop towards the end. I love them, and it in shoegaze circles, it is a pretty big fucking deal that they've reunited. But I would never go to a festival like this to see, you know, five bands.
Yeah, Coachella. Fuck you. I didn't really have anything to say. Sorry, I let that drop.
All I'm saying is punk rock bowling is blowing Coachella out of the water this year. That's all I'm saying.
All right, one more story before we wrap up here. Another sad one. This, unfortunately, a little bit overshadowed by the death of Lemmy that happened like the day before, if not the same day. But the Specials drummer, John Bradbury, he died at the age of 62. This would have been on probably the 28th of December. Bradbury, he was considered a key contributor to the two-tone sound that was pioneered by bands like The Specials and The Selector and all those groups. He joined The Specials in 1979. He was part of the band, the band's incarnation that was called The Special AKA, that followed the Specials' early 80s breakup. He played on 1984's hit Free Nelson Mandela, which was one of the band's biggest songs. He also co-wrote The Selector. So that's pretty cool. He was involved in the band's reunion shows as of late. In 2008, he performed with them, and he continued to perform with them up until his death. So he was one of the current members of the touring band, The Specials. So, you know, our condolences go out to John Bradbury's friends and family and fans and all that. But that also is a sad one from a weird week there at the end of December. So.
Do you guys ever get to see The Specials live?
I don't think that I did. I feel that I've definitely been to a show where members of the specials have been involved in this or that, but it was not like a full special show.
I was reminded by a friend of mine that I actually did see them in like 96 or 97 when I went to visit family friends in Salt Lake City. And, you know, that was when, you know, the whole third wave ska thing was happening. Mm. So I was really into all that shit, you know, Boston's and whatnot. And it was pretty fucking rad to see, you know, a band that influenced, or I hope influenced, a lot of those bands, that they would actually go back and listen to stuff like the specials. So that was pretty rad.
Honestly, whenever I go back and look at the bills of shows or festivals that I have been to these days and see the bands that played it and realize that, like, I did not watch those bands and didn't care at the time, I feel like a total failure.
Well, this was like a show. Yeah, if it was like, oh, they played Warped Tour for some reason, like, I probably, I'm too tired to go see whatever that band, old man band is. But yeah, like, we specifically went for them. I can't remember who opened, but it was a two band bill, so they played a really fucking long set from what I can remember, which is not much because it was 20 years ago.
I could have saw Joe Strummer for $25 and did not go.
Oh,
I don't want to start my story, but when I blew going to see Joe Strummer, because it pains me. It fucking pains me. All right, so we're going to play one more song before we get out of here. This is a new band. They're a hardcore band out of Welland, Ontario, which is just down the road from me here. They're called Sideman. And Sideman, I saw them live for the first time. I had never really seen them before that. But I'd absolutely seen everyone that was in Sideman when they were playing live. It's definitely a band that at least their stage presence was a lot of the regulars from the Niagara music scene that were up there. The band, he's a hardcore band with two vocalists. The one guy's name is Justice Carr. Carr plays in Single Mothers.
Is actually Justice Carr?
His name is Justis. Sorry, Krar, Krar.
Is that a punk name?
I don't think it is. I think it might be
Justice Krar.
I don't know. It's. I don't know. I'm not going to say.
My name is Worf, son of Moog, and I'm here to challenge for the Klingon Council, Justice Krar.
It's got a little bit of that, eh? But anyways, though. So he plays in Sideman's world, and Sideman is there's a really specific kind of tongue-in-cheek, we're having a lot of fun with this, but we're actually doing it for real thing that is happening with this band when they're on stage. So as far as Sideman goes, he is J-Man. And the other vocalist in the band is a guy named Big Mill. Now, Big Mill, we all know Big Mill around here. Big Mill is a guy named Ross Miller. Ross plays in just about every band that I have ever seen in Niagara in some form or another. He is one of these like multi-instrumental people that I can't recall him ever seeing him in a group where he has been a front man before, but he is always playing with anyone. He's good friends with the guys in Attack in Black. And I remember that when Attack in Black played one of their last shows here in town, they were convinced to go and to play some of kind of like the early hardcore stuff that they had done back when they were more of a punk band and less of sort of like a weird country indie rock act that they became. And the band wanted they played the song. They listened to the crowd, but they didn't really want to be the ones singing those songs. This was just as kind of Daniel Romano was starting to move into his country thing. So he didn't want to be singing those hardcore songs. It wasn't where he was at. But of course, Ross Miller could get up on stage and sing those songs. And then in every like Attack in Black spinoff group, Ross always seems to be on stage with them playing. He's played with the Trilliums, which is Dan Romano's band. I've seen him playing with Marine Dreams. He's always playing with those guys. He's always involved in that scene. Anyways, but this is Ross up on stage as well, being one of the frontmen. So there are two frontmen to Sideman. And I actually popped online earlier and I was talking to John about this. And I'm like, John, hardcore bands with two frontmen that aren't playing guitar or anything, they're just singing. And we were trying to figure out a list, and you had a good one. Like Neurosis was in the top.
No, Nausea, not Neurosis.
Shit. But anyways, though, it's a super weird, super fun dynamic. There's actually a really heavy, like Beastie Boys vibe to what they're doing when they're on stage together, and not sonically. I mean, like, yeah, like the hardcore that they play is actually super, super similar to like the kind of hardcore songs that Beasties would have played. But just in terms of their, like, you know, jokey banter between the two frontmen as they're doing their thing, it is very much more the kind of thing that you would see at a hip hop show than a hardcore one. So anyways, we're going to play a song called Rhythmic Perspective. It's from one of the EPs that Sideman released in late 2005. This one from the EP of the same name, Rhythmic Perspective. So here you go. They have a record release show that's going to come up in, looking at my calendar, on the 16th of January at the back of some alleyway in Welland, Ontario, as I understand it. So, you know, go see them because it'll be really fun, and I'll be there. So this is Sideman. Here you go. And that was Sideman, and that was a really long intro to that. So anyways, yeah. John, we're done. This is the first show of 2016. No one died.
Pop that champagne, baby. I think we're off to a good start.
I died.
Listen, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. Thanks for listening. Write us. And listen, we're excited to kick off 2016. And what can I say? But as always, we will see you. We'll see y'all. We'll see you all. We'll see y'all next week.